the organizers have really transformed the dream of many of us into this reality that I see before me. So I must say I'm really happy today. So as Sudhakar said, this is the this is the first part of a talk on non-commutative solitons, of which you'll hear the second part today afternoon from Shiraz Minwala, my collaborator. And so the last year has seen a rather intensive study of non-commutativity in field theory. So let's ask why. Among many possible reasons, many overlapping reasons, are some of the following over here. So firstly, it arises as very naturally in terms as a limit of string theory. And it has proved useful in the past to study various limits of string theory, various limits of moduli space of string theory. And so it's very natural to do that, one might say so. But more importantly, these theories display a non-locality, which is very stringy in nature, but yet in some conceptual and computational sense, more controllable. So a very related aspect of this is that if you view these as quantum field theories, then even though they seem to be very violent non-local deformations of quantum of the structure of local quantum field theories, they seem to make sense rather surprisingly, at least in a perturbative expansion. They seem renormalizable despite having this mixing between energy scales and so on. So all this might suggest that it might be worthwhile to understand these theories as some kind of toy model for at least some aspects of quantum gravity, which show many of these above phenomena. And if you accept that, then it's very necessary to have in this theory some class of objects which can be used as sort of probes of the stringiness of the theory. And this, the non-commutative field theories happen to possess in abundance in the form of various very novel classical solutions. We'll see that these solutions have played a role in understanding at least some stringy phenomena like tachyon condensation on open brain systems. But I believe that possibly others where they play a very nice illuminating role as well. In any case, because of these motivations, my talk will be on the field theoretic aspects of non-commutative solitons. I'll emphasize the very unusual field theory features that these solitons possess, and which might teach us something about string theory. There'll be basically two categories of non-commutative field theories that we will consider solitons in. The first is sort of the simplest of purely scalar theory. I'll go over some basics in this paper with Shiraz Minwala and Andy Strominger from March, then go on to talk about some preliminary results with Matt Hedrick, a student at Harvard, on some properties of multi-solitons in this theory, which turn out to be very useful in constructing periodic arrays of these solitons, or equivalently considering these solitons in various quotient spaces. We'll talk a bit about the non-commutative gauge theories, which are the other interesting set of non-commutative field theories, which possess novel localized flux solutions. This will be mostly based on a paper with Mina Aganajic, Shiraz Minwala, and Andy Strominger. But sometime around here, I'll pass the baton on to Shiraz to develop the story in more detail. So before plunging into these details, I wanted to highlight some of these very unusual features of non-commutative solitons, which make them very rather wonderful objects to play around with. So Consider the simplest case of a scalar theory and some arbitrary potential. We'll mostly be in sort of 2+1 dimensions. The remarkable fact is that in ordinary commutative theories, because of Dirac's theorem, you don't have a finite energy localized classical solutions in such theories. But over here, you find solutions which evade this theorem, and a rough picture of which is something I've tried to draw over here. Namely, these are solutions which sort of explore in field space a region around a false vacuum. So there's sort of a localized bubble of a false vacuum of scale non-commutativity. And this field explores actually the whole region in field space between this false vacuum and the true vacuum. It asymptotes to the true vacuum. But the remarkable feature of these solitons is that though the field explores this whole region in field space, the solution happens to depend only on the particular value of the minimum of this potential, and not on its profile, not on any details of this potential. And in particular, the energy is independent of, again, the details of the profile of the potential, and just depends on the minimum. You could have a barrier between the false and the true vacuum, which could be as high as you want, but still the soliton would not be sensitive to that. So all this is sort of a signature of non-locality in the theory. The fact that this theory is has actually infinitely many derivatives or is non-local allows the field to explore all these even regions which are classically very classically sort of highly forbidden. To nevertheless be independent of the details of the potential. Another feature which is again quite remarkable is that these theories possess quite large symmetries. In the case of the scalars, there's at least in a certain leading order approximation a large U infinity global symmetry, which happens to be gauged in the gauge theories. As a result of this, leads to some nice features, like the fact that the fluctuation spectrum about these solitons has a very non-abelian nature. So it's very like D-brains, and indeed that aspect was exploited and was used in the nice work on understanding tachyon condensation on brains by these two groups. Another feature which exists for scalars, which I'll talk about a bit, is that there's some kind of a, even for the purely scalar case, there's some kind of a Bogomolny bound, as we'll see, on energies, which lead to an approximate no-force condition on widely separated solitons. And this happens to be very useful in constructing periodic arrays of solitons, or solitons and quotient spaces, and so on. So again, this is not something you normally expect in purely scalar theories, but happens to be true over here. There are non-BPS solutions in the gauge theory, as I briefly mentioned, which actually you can exactly find for all values of non-commutativity, and carry integer flux, strangely only positive integer flux. This other feature that even when the moduli space of these solutions happen to have singularities, the solutions themselves happen to be smooth. And this sort of also has a nice flavor, which you might expect of string theory. So these are some of the features I wanted to highlight before we look at some of the details. For instance, in a non-commutative scalar field theory, for instance, in 2+1 dimensions, static configurations would have an energy functional of this form with potential with star products defined in this Moyle way and using this Moyle kernel. What has been very useful in at least studying classical solutions, and presumably even should be useful even in the quantum theory, is to map this form of the functional into a sort of a matrix model by using this nice isomorphism between the Moyle product and operator multiplication, which leads you to replace fields with operators and the star product with just the product of operators. Another feature is that traces or integrals of functionals, become traces in the Hilbert space. So the Hilbert space in question is in the simplest case of 2+1 dimensions, just that of a one-dimensional quantum mechanics. So derivatives, for instance, in this holomorphic derivatives, become actually simple commutators with the creation, annihilation, harmonic creation, harmonic oscillator creation, annihilation operators. And using this map, the energy functional becomes this kind of a matrix model over here with the kinetic term and the potential term. The thing to note is that this term is the only term which carries any dependence on the non-commutativity, and it's useful to consider a limit where this term is dominant. So we study the classical solutions in an expansion about the very large non-commutativity, or keeping this sort of a dimensionless quantity involving a mass scale very small. So in the limit when epsilon is zero, you can drop that kinetic term. And the equation of motion, I've written now in the operator language, dropping all hats. The equation of motion is simply an operator equation of that form. And a simple solution is in terms of projection operators in this Hilbert space, with coefficients being extrema of the potential. So this is, again, what I meant by the fact that the solutions don't depend on the details of the potential, just the extrema. So this, for instance, a projector onto the ground state is a very simple example of such a solution. And this is essentially a Gaussian in space-time. This has energy. It's easy to check, again, using the map, that this has energy, which is just depends on the value of the potential at the extremum. A general solution involves a linear combination, a particular linear combination of orthogonal projection operators. So these are orthogonal, with coefficients, again, being extrema of the potential and the energy. This is the general form of the solution, but this solution is classically stable only if these coefficients are all minima of the potential. If you now look at fluctuations about this solution, once again, from the operator language, it's easy to see that the Lagrangian has a U infinity symmetry, or just a unitary symmetries in the Hilbert space, which take you from one solution to another. For instance, at level one, or sort of a one-dimensional projection operator, all such projection operators have the same energy, since they are unitarily related, and so there's a sort of a continuous moduli space on which they fall. But if you now go to finite non-commutativity, then you need to add in this kinetic term, and the equation of motion is something like that. And this kinetic term leads to corrections to the solution we just had by terms of order epsilon. I'll use a sort of a convention where the potential energy I'll call of order 1 and the kinetic energy of order epsilon, in which case this corrections to the solution change energies only at order epsilon square, since we are expanding about sort of a extremum of the equations of extremum of the functional. So the leading correction to the energy at finite epsilon is at small epsilon comes from just the value of the kinetic energy of the original solution phi naught, which I've called phi naught. So you just have to plug in the original solution into the kinetic energy, and this is order epsilon suppressed with respect to the original energy from the potential term, and this is the leading contribution. And when you take that into account, of all the radial solutions, the Gaussian has the lowest energy simply because all the others have sort of more oscillations and are hence more kinetic energy, which is also reflected in the fact that these other solutions, now the zero modes are lifted, become tachyonic, and the only stable solution at level one, so to say, for large and finite theta is the Gaussian plus these small corrections. So much for a level one soliton. What about if you go to a higher levels? Let's again stick to theta equal to infinity first, epsilon equal to zero. Then an arbitrary radial solution is sort of a sum of projection operators of this kind, orthonormal projection operators. So if you want to separate the solitons, the best way to do that is to act on, say, a ket in the Hilbert space by a generator of translations. And you would get, this would be a soliton which would be localized at some point z, zi. But if you want to have multiple separated solitons, since this kets are not orthonormal, you have to orthonormalize it and form projection operators which correspond to the solutions. And a simple illustration is in the simplest case, where you start with a Gaussian or the ground state of the harmonic oscillator and form this coherent state by acting on by this translation generator. Again, these are not orthonormal, so you form for two solitons, you form an orthonormal combination of something at z and something at minus z, you can write down a projection operator, a level two projection operator now, which has the nice property that when the separation z is very large, then it reduces to two Gaussians at plus and minus z, while when z is when the separation goes to zero, it reduces to the lowest level two radial solution. Since this is a projection operator at level two, its potential energy is independent of z, so all these solutions sort of are degenerate. They feel no force at leading order in epsilon. But the surprising thing is that you might expect at next order in epsilon, when you put this into the kinetic energy, that this degeneracy is lifted, that now you no longer have a moduli space. But the surprising thing happens to be that precisely for these sort of coherent states, of the Gaussian, the kinetic energy of such a projection operator such a soliton is independent of the separation. In other words, even at order epsilon, the separated Gaussian solutions in this purely scalar theory feel no force, and this is actually happens to be true for any number of separated Gaussians. In other words, there's sort of a moduli space of solutions even for energies of order epsilon. So why is that? I mean, it's not so easily understandable if you look at it from any field theoretic point of view. But there's an algebraic reason why that's so. There's some kind of a Bogomolny bound that the kinetic term satisfies for projection operators. You can, for any arbitrary projection operator, the kinetic energy term the order epsilon term is simply something like this. You can show through some manipulations that this is equal to this. In other words, it's greater than or equal to a purely topological sort of term plus a positive definite part. So it's always greater than or equal to something which just depends on the dimension onto which the projection operator projects onto. So I've called H parallel the subspace on which the projection operator is one, and H perpendicular is the orthogonal space. And the nice thing, the sort of the Bogomolny-like thing, is that this equality holds only when the subspace onto which the projection operator projects onto is left invariant by the action of this annihilation operator A. One instance where that happens and which which sort of seems natural is when you consider a projection operator onto the first n states of the harmonic oscillator. I goes from 1 to n, 0 to n minus 1, then it's easy to see that this space is left invariant under action by the annihilation operator. But this is not the case if you were to take some random set of kets as your basis for your projection operator. But another space for which this Bogomolny equality is saturated is for a space of coherent states. In other words, the coherent states are eigenstates of the annihilation operator, and hence they obey this, and they saturate this bound, which explains why this soliton that we constructed out of a basis of coherent states did not feel any force. So it was the kinetic term did not lift the degeneracy of these solitons. This is a useful property and can be exploited to construct stable non-commutative solitons at finite theta when you're working on some kind of quotient spaces. The simplest example, and which I'll just concentrate on, is one of a periodic array of solitons, say a one-dimensional periodic array. So how do you construct? So let's first work at theta equal to infinity. How do you construct such a periodic array of solitons? The simplest thing is to work in the covering space and find projection operators which are invariant under some discrete translations. For instance, you can have, I've written over here the translation generator for translation by n times some radius. So you require your projection operator to satisfy something like that. It's easy to construct projection operators that obey this. What you do is start with some arbitrary ket in your Hilbert space. Take some linear combination of it acted on by translation generators, and I'm calling that resulting ket phi r because it's translated by r. Now you choose these linear combination in such a way that this ket and its translates form an orthonormal set. It turns out this can always be done. And when you do that, then this space spanned by this and its translates form orthonormal, I mean, you can form an orthonormal projection operator from this, and hence this happens to be also a solution. This is now a solution at theta equal to infinity on the cylinder. It has the required properties. Being a projection operator, all the different solitons that you form like this are degenerate in energy at order one, so from the potential term. But what happens at finite theta? This is where the Bogomolny bound comes in useful. One can construct analog of the Gaussian in flat space, which in R2, which was the lowest stable solution, by working with a ket, starting with the ket phi naught, which is just the ground state. Then the nice thing about this is that it translates by some discrete amount. I form a Hilbert space, span a Hilbert space, which is invariant under the action of the annihilation operator, and hence the corresponding projection operator that you would form out of this saturates this sort of a Bogomolny bound for the kinetic energy, and therefore is sort of the lowest energy state. In particular, I've written down here the explicit form for the projection operator that you would get on a cylinder of radius r. It has this simple form in terms of projection operators, but when you write it in terms of in position space, it seems a little complicated, but actually has a nice form in terms of theta functions. What is very surprising here is that this from this form of this function, it doesn't at all seem that you have both the kinetic and the potential energy of such a soliton independent of this radius r, but that happens to be the case. I don't know of a direct way to verify this. I think numerically one can check that this is so, but this general argument tells you that it must be the case. This is just a small plot of what these solutions look like. So when the radius, so this is, I've drawn three copies, if you wish. When the radius is very large, then these look like Gaussian solitons, not surprisingly. But when you make the radius smaller, they look very unlike Gaussians. They sort of start embracing each other, and then they form a sort of, and when you make it really small, it forms a very unusual sort of, it goes over into a shelf kind of form, except for sort of isolated points. So that's just how this complicated theta function looks like. So since I have 2 minutes left, I'll just briefly present the solutions for the non-commutative gauge fields, and Shiraz will take over. So again, in 2+1 dimensions, the non-commutative gauge field, so far we have considered scalar fields. Now I'll consider purely gauge fields. In 2+1 dimensions, the energy functional, once again, for static configurations in a useful gauge is something like this, where the field strength is this non-commutative field strength in terms of the gauge field. So it has these star products over here. So this is, for instance, for a U1 theory, but you can generalize this to UN. Once again, it's useful to analyze this sort of a functional via its map to operators. You can define a covariant derivative. I mean, the covariant derivative in this theory, the conventional covariant derivative, maps onto an operator which is like this, not surprisingly, because the derivative, ordinary derivative, maps to something like this, and this is the operator corresponding to the gauge field, and these we'll call C and C bar. Under this map, the field strength takes a very simple algebraic form. It's just simply CC bar plus 1 over theta, 1 over theta coming from these terms. So the energy of the, so this functional over here becomes sort of a purely algebraic functional which looks like this. So it's a very simple matrix model with an even simpler looking equation of motion. And it is to this that one can find solutions. I'll just present these solutions, which were originally found by Polychronakos and also Bach, but independently by us. A solution to this, which is trivial, is just the vacuum solution where the gauge field is zero. But a non-trivial solution is one in which you sort of shift the gauge field in a sense. I mean, shift the vacuum in this way with a shift operator. So the shift operator has some nice properties which I have written over here, which enables this to satisfy the equations of motion. And if you compute the flux of such a solution, so remembering that the field strength is proportional to this combination, and the integer flux is the integral of the field strength, you find that this has integer flux 1 and finite energy, something like that. But it's an unstable soliton since this flux over here, which actually is proportional to a Gaussian, can be lowered by spreading the flux out sort of uniformly. So the details of this and its significance in string theory is something that Shiraz will talk about. So let me conclude over here.
Thank you. So we have 5 minutes for questions and answer session. Invite the questions.
When you showed the existence of a moduli space of solutions, which you showed by your BPS property, that was based on considering the kinetic energy as a perturbation. But I didn't understand whether you demonstrated it to first order in the perturbation or exactly.
So it is to first order in the perturbation. It is to first order in the perturbation. And in particular, to next leading order in the perturbation, if you're on R2, these solitons will have an attractive force. So there's a moduli space only for energies sort of order epsilon in this perturbation expansion. But this was nevertheless useful in studying the stable solutions on. This is useful in studying the stable solutions on quotient spaces where you don't have this so there you have a fixed separation, and hence over there you can start with the solution that I wrote down for the projection operator and make consistent. The projection operator on the cylinder is the starting point for. Perturbation expansion, which gives you the lowest state in some interval about theta equal to infinity.
Any more questions, please? Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank the speaker again. Okay, the next speaker is Jorge Russo. And he will be speaking on free energy and critical temperature in 11 dimensions.